morning. Thank you all for sticking around for this session. So the title of the talk is a little bit different than what's listed in the program. I'm going to look at missed opportunities in obesity care with respect to practice patterns of physicians around obesity diagnosis and who receives weight-related counseling. And this is done in collaboration with some colleagues at Johns Hopkins, which is where I am. And I have no disclosures to report. So why does this issue matter? Well, we know, for example, in the US, that if you're an obese patient and you go to the doctor, there's about a 30% chance a doctor's going to say to you and give you a diagnosis. Similarly, if you're an obese patient and you go to the doctor, there's about a 30% chance you're going to get some type of obesity management. And it's further complicated by the fact that who receives obesity management is not uniform across different population groups. So for example, if you're white, if you're higher income, if you're higher educated, groups that are lower risk for obesity, there are higher probabilities of actually getting weight-related counseling. And it could be, potentially, that how physicians practice with respect to obesity patients could be in some way related to the disparities that we see at the population level with respect to obesity. And so what we want to look at here, what are some of the variations when patients go and see their physicians to get help with respect to their obesity? Now, we argue that there are three primary reasons why physician practice patterns are important. The first is that we know that physicians play a really important role when it comes to patient modification of their risk behavior. So for example, if you're an obese patient and you go to the doctor and they tell you that your weight is too high, there's a good probability that you're going to make an effort to work on your weight on the average. There's also a good chance that if a patient is advised to modify their behavior, they're more confident and they're more motivated to engage in various lifestyle modifications. Now, if you take a step back and think back to smoking cessation in the 1970s, physicians were incredibly influential in getting patients to stop smoking simply by telling them that it was bad for their health. And so we can draw some nice corollaries between smoking and obesity when we think about the role of physicians. Also important is that physicians as a group are extremely well positioned to deal with obesity because in a given year, for example, 2005, there were over 100 million visits. Obesity is obviously a very large problem here in the US, and the sheer volume of patients that go to the doctor make it very easy for doctors to have an impact. And the final reason why it matters, we argue, is that patients trust physicians. And we know that trust is a really important precursor to behavior change. And so if you look at patterns of trust over the past 10 years or so, what you can see is that in the dark gray you have, I do trust my physician, and in light gray you have, I don't trust my physician. Now the take-home point from this slide is that over the past 10 years or so, more than 80% of the population says, I trust my physician. And that matters because, again, trust is a really important precursor to whether or not, let's say I'm an obese patient, whether or not I'm willing to modify my behavior. Now, as we see it, there's two contributions of the research that I'm going to present today. The first is that every other study that's looked at this area of research has used self-reported height and weight. Now, why does that matter? Well, if you ask women how much they weigh, they're going to tell you that they're lighter than they actually are. If you ask men how tall they are, they all of a sudden have grown a few inches. And so that leads to a bias of who actually is obese and who's not obese. And so we have the opportunity with this data I'll talk to you about in a second to look at a population at the national level with measured height and weight. And in that way, we can get a very precise estimate of who's actually obese. Now the second contribution as we see it is that the current federal priorities laid out by Healthy People 2010 and by the US Preventive Task Force say we want to reduce adult obesity and we want to eliminate health disparities. And this research is right in line with those objectives. And so we're interested in two research questions. The primary one is, does the likelihood of an obesity diagnosis map to population prevalence? So what do I mean by that? If you are a person who is at higher risk for being obese, do you also have a higher likelihood of getting a diagnosis when you go to the doctor? That's question number one. Question number two is, are there certain patient characteristics, physician characteristics, or characteristics of the clinical encounter that are associated with whether or not a person gets a diagnosis or weight-related counseling? Now, what we expect is that patients who are less likely to get obesity care will also have the same or higher risk of actually being obese. So we expect to see a disconnect between prevalence and care. Now, the data which I briefly mentioned is coming from the 05-06 National Ambulatory Medical Care Survey, which I'll refer to as the NAMSIS. And it's a national representative survey of patients reported by physicians. And the physicians are randomly sampled from the American Medical Association and American Osteopathic Association master files. And what they do is for a given week, they go into the physician's files and they take between a 20% and 100% sample of those patients. And again, the key unique feature of this data in this particular year is the opportunity to look at measured height and weight. So you have a patient's actual BMI. The data is cross-sectional and the world of people that we care about are obese adults ages 18 and older. which gives us a sample of about 2,500 people. And we use logistic regression to model our outcome variables of interest, which are all dichotomous, the primary one here being obesity diagnosis, and then three different types of weight-related counseling: reduction, diet, and exercise. On the right-hand side, you have what we view as the covariates of interest. So what did we find? Well, if you start here on the top line, obesity prevalence up here, what you can see is that very similar to other national estimates coming out of the CDC, in this case the National Health and Examination Nutrition Survey, about a third of the adult population is obese, which is exactly what we would expect. Now, if you look at the second line, well, who's getting an obesity diagnosis? What this tells you is that conditional on being obese, a third of patients who walk into their doctor's office are getting told they're obese. So there's a big problem there, right? Really, really serious underreporting. But this isn't new. We've seen this in literature before. Now, if you break this down by demographic groups, this is what you find. Now, let me walk you through this. So down here in dark gray, you've got rates of diagnosis. In light gray, you've got population prevalence of obesity for both genders, race ethnicity groups, age groups, and region. Now, the first thing to point out here is that if you look at the dark gray bars going across the bottom, rates of diagnosis are very low. So that's point number one. Point number two is that there is a disconnect between who is at highest risk and who is getting diagnosed when they go to the doctor. So let's start over here with gender. If you look at the top and you compare these two bars right here, what you see is that men have a higher underlying population risk of being obese. But if you look down here at who's getting diagnosed, women have a higher likelihood of being diagnosed. If you move over to the race groups and you compare whites to Hispanics, what you see is that Hispanics up here have a much higher risk of being obese as compared to whites right here. But if you look down here at who's getting diagnosed between whites and Hispanics, it is almost identical. By age, middle-aged adults have the highest likelihood of being obese, but look at diagnosis rates among the younger and the middle-aged age groups. Again, they're almost the same. And finally, if we move over here to different regions, compare the Midwest to the South. Underlying risk is identical, but look at these differences in diagnosis rates. Similarly, compare diagnosis rates in the South and the West, but then look at risk. It's not the same. And so what this suggests is that there's this lack of sensitivity among physicians when it comes to underlying patient risk for obesity when they're getting diagnosed. Or that's one possible conclusion from these data. Now, if you look at the model, which shows you the odds for the predictors of obesity diagnosis, in orange you have the significant numbers, what you see is that if you're female compared to being male, your odds are twice as high. If you are young compared to being elderly, your odds of an obesity diagnosis are more than twice as high. If you live in the Midwest compared to the West, your odds are about twice as high. And then down here, if you look at someone's comorbidity risk status, then your odds also increase. Now that's what you would expect, right? If you go to the physician and you've got high comorbidity risk, things like ischemic heart disease or diabetes or hypertension, you would expect that patient to have a higher likelihood of getting diagnosed as obese. And that's what we're seeing here. What we're not seeing is a sensitivity among physicians to actually who's at higher risk for being obese in the first place when it comes to receiving a diagnosis. So let's switch gears and let's look at, well, what's happening with weight-related counseling? So now we're on the management side. And what you see is that with respect to these three different types of counseling, weight reduction, diet, and exercise, that only about a fourth of patients are going to be counseled to reduce their weight or exercise, and about a fifth are going to be counseled to go on a diet. So that's a very small minority of all patients who are obese. Now, it's worth pointing out that even if patients have counseling for their weight, in no way means they're actually going to lose weight. In fact, it may help some patients and not help others. But given that obesity is such a large problem, even very small changes at the individual level can have a very large public health impact at the population level, which is why these little solutions when it comes to obesity may be very important. And if we turn to say, well, what's driving who gets weight-related counseling? What we see is that a diagnosis is the biggest predictor. So if you have an obesity diagnosis, you have 6 times the odds of receiving weight reduction counseling, 3 times the odds of getting diet counseling, and about 2.5 times the odds of exercise counseling. Now, why these odds ratios differ by counseling type is not clear. Perhaps we can discuss that if you want. What is clear is that getting an obesity diagnosis is a really important gateway to actually getting the treatment that you need if you're an obese individual here in the United States. So to wrap up, the sort of main takeaway points from this are suboptimal rates of obesity diagnosis with respect to both who is getting diagnosed and then who is getting the appropriate care management, assuming that they have the diagnosis. And the other thing I think that is most important is who is at highest risk in the population for actually being obese is not consistent with who is actually receiving a diagnosis when they go to the doctor's office, which in my mind represents a lack of sensitivity among physicians of who's got the highest underlying population risk. And then again, when it comes to actually who's going to get weight-related counseling, getting an actual obesity diagnosis then becomes very important. There are limitations worth noting. Because the data is cross-sectional, we can't make causal inferences, and we're relying on physician reports, which to some extent could lead to underreporting, and we also have no way of objectively verifying it. Now, the NAMSIS has been objectively verified in the past, and it's shown that physicians say they provide a service, there's a very good chance they actually do, and so we feel pretty confident with these numbers. Now, we also have the problem of it could be that the snapshot of services that we have for our population doesn't reflect services provided at another time, which is not captured by the survey. Now, we control for whether or not the person was seen at another point during the year. And so we get at that bias to a certain extent, but it's possible it still introduced some change to our estimates in the data. And so from a policy perspective, what we're seeing is there are all these missed opportunities when it comes to obesity care, which is problematic. But it's not so simple as to go into the doctor's office and say, physicians, I need you to do X. As the second talk was telling us, you know, primary care physicians have a lot on their plate. And anyone that wants to sort of work in this area needs to have some sensitivity to the fact that barriers to have physicians provide appropriate care have been documented. And so those should be taken into account when we think about how can we make do a better job at making sure that if you're obese and you go to the doctor, you get appropriately diagnosed and you appropriately receive care. Now, potentially, we can think about ways to technologically move this effort. So electronic medical records, for example, might be a really nice way to help physicians easily identify who's at risk, particularly for those groups disproportionately impacted by obesity. And then the final point is, again, at the individual level, just identifying and treating a person may have a very small impact. But given that one-third of our entire population has this problem, potentially, if you have an additive effect, it could have a very large public health and clinical significance. So thank you very much.